This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, May 6th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In 2017, Brandi Levy, a junior varsity cheerleader at Mahanoy Area High School in Mahanoy City, Pennsylvania, was denied a spot on the school's varsity squad. That weekend, off campus, Levy posted a furious, profanity-filled photo and message about the decision on Snapchat. A student who saw the message showed a screenshot to her mother, the cheer coach. Levy was barred from cheerleading for the rest of the year. The ACLU filed suit against the school on behalf of Levy in federal court, claiming that her First Amendment right to free speech had been curtailed. Last week, 4 years after that pivotal snap, the United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of Mahanoy Area School District v. BL. In this era of social media and remote schooling, when students spend much of their lives online, the question of what authority schools have to police student speech, especially off school premises, has become increasingly complicated. During oral arguments, Justice Stephen Breyer described the many issues now facing school administrators.
A few years ago, a superintendent of schools, I think in San Francisco, said, "You know, schools have changed a lot, the public schools, since when I went there." He said, "Today we don't just teach classical subjects. We're there to help the child have adequate health, in many cases to see that he's adequately fed. In quite a few cases, we become a caretaker and we don't want to send them home immediately because there's nobody home. And we have to plan after school activities. There are dozens of areas that didn't used to be thought of as within the purview of the public school. Today, in many places, they are." Now add to that the internet. And the internet not just listening to teachers, but also doing homework. And also writing papers, sometimes vaguely defined. And sometimes. How do I get a standard out of that? I'm frightened to death of writing a standard.
Jeannie Sue Gerson, a contributing writer to The New Yorker and a professor at Harvard Law School, joins me to discuss this contentious case and what it means for free speech in the digital age. Jeannie, welcome.
Thank you, Dorothy.
So Mahanoy is the first case before the court to address whether public schools can punish students for off-campus speech. Maybe just start by telling us first what Brandi Levy's offense was, and why did the justices agree to hear the case?
So Brandi Levy posted a message on Snapchat that showed her and her friend giving the middle finger, and she then also used some profanity, insulting the school, the cheer team, and she mainly was just saying she was really frustrated about not making the cheer team. Those were the messages that caught the attention, of course, of the school and of the coaches, and they decided that she had violated team rules and school rules.
So it seems at first glance that this is just, you know, business as usual. I mean, teenagers go on online all the time to express themselves with profanity and other things. Why did the justices want to hear this case?
Well, I think the justices really wanted to hear this case mainly because the decision below in the Third Circuit was very sweeping in saying that schools do not have power to regulate student speech off campus. Now, that's a pretty absolutist kind of rule. And they did not think that that in itself, I think, could just stand without at least some addressing or clarification. There probably needs to be some more nuance to what schools can do in this day and age when you have most communication that's occurring between students, whether they're on school grounds or off school grounds. A lot of it is happening online. And so I think for the digital age and the nature of students' communication and for the school's guidance to schools on what they may or may not regulate, it was time for the justices to take such a case to try to give some order to this situation, because the last really significant case that the Supreme Court had heard on school speech was in 2007. And we're in a different time now. And so this was likely why the Supreme Court thought that this would be a good idea to take the case.
And maybe let's go back even further, because I think it's really helpful to see this in perspective. Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District occurred in 1969. So maybe tell us a little bit about that, and then also about the case you mentioned, Morris v. Frederick, in 2007. It does feel as though there's been a gradual weakening of student rights to free speech over the years.
Well, in 1969, there was a case called Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District. That case involved some students who came to school wearing black armbands that were in silent protest of the Vietnam War. The school had banned the wearing of such armbands, and so the school punished these students. And then that case, when it went to the Supreme Court, the court said that because the expression of opinion didn't cause disruption to the school, like it didn't substantially interfere with the work of the school, it didn't harm any other students' rights, that meant that this was speech that was protected by the First Amendment. And so the school could not punish students for doing that. So that was the 1969 case of Tinker, and that is the case we're still dealing with. And in several cases after Tinker, the Supreme Court encountered certain situations in which students did things that the school punished, and the Supreme Court found that that was fine under the First Amendment. One of them is the 2007 case of Morris versus Frederick, where the court said that a public school did not violate the First Amendment when it suspended a student who unfurled a large banner stating "Bong hits for Jesus" at a school sanctioned event. After Tinker, all of the other Supreme Court cases we get on student speech in school essentially say that schools have a lot of leeway to regulate student speech, and it is okay to suspend students for speech that is disruptive to the school. So now in 2021, we've got the cheerleader case. That doesn't happen on school grounds. It happens online, off campus. And the idea is, if that speech is deemed disruptive to the school, then can the school actually suspend, discipline, and punish the student? And so that's this off-campus, on-campus distinction is one that is that's going to be central to this case. And I think that one position is that, yes, absolutely, there's a bar. Once the school student leaves the school grounds, then that's just off limits for schools to regulate. And then there's the argument on the other side, which is that no matter where the school student is, if it is disruptive to the school, then the school can regulate it. And then there are all kinds of positions in the middle.
And I thought the oral arguments in the current case on last Wednesday were completely fascinating and made it clear that this is going to have really far-reaching significance. And I thought you could just give us a brief sense of the range of concerns raised by justices from Brett Kavanaugh on the right to Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, you know, on the more progressive wing.
I think all of the justices seemed concerned about the question of bullying. They did seem to think that schools have leeway or should have some ability to punish students or prohibit their bullying. And the question really was, what are the limits of that? And so bullying and harassment, discriminatory comments, what is discriminatory, what is bullying for this purpose? I think that ran through the oral argument. So for example, Justice Sotomayor asked about someone who is a female student who's told, "You're so ugly, why are you even alive?" by a group of classmates. And Justice Alito asked, well, can the school discipline a student who believes that someone who, say, a transgender female student wants to be referred to by female pronouns, but then a student refers to the student by male pronouns. Is that something that a school can do something about? Those are the kinds of things that kept coming up again and again in the oral argument. And I think that it was because the idea is if the public schools lack power to regulate and discipline speech, if it's happening off campus, then students at the school may feel that they're being discriminated against, that they're being harassed, and the school may not have any power to do anything about it as long as it is not happening on school grounds. Even on school grounds, there's a question that these kinds of statements may not rise to the level of disruption, which is now the test after Tinker in 1969. But as we know, public schools have been regulating harassing and bullying and discriminatory speech. And so this case, it may be an opportunity for the Supreme Court to say what the limits are for public schools in doing that.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
It was interesting to see that both right-wing and left-wing groups filed amicus briefs in support of Levy. You don't usually see the ACLU and Americans for Prosperity on the same side. What's the reasoning there?
Well, I think that both sides have reason to fear that their speech, whether left-wing speech, progressive speech, or right-wing speech, or religious speech, might come under disfavor by school authorities. And so, and depending on what region of the country you're in or what kind of public school district it is, who are the people who live there. And both sides have reason to think, well, do we really trust school authorities to make these calls? Shouldn't it really be parents who get to determine what the beliefs and the values and the speech of the children should be, especially off campus? At the same time, public schools will feel that because of the prevalence of online communication between students and how influential those communications are in what happens in school and the relationships among the students, that basically everything that happens online has the potential to disrupt the school and to disrupt the learning environment and the access to education for the students at the school.
And bullying is a major concern, very legitimate major concern. What have legislators and the courts already done to address cyberbullying and discrimination? And what might the consequences be if the court rules in Levy's favor?
Well, so first of all, there is a lot of law on bullying, apart from the many, many schools, the vast majority that already have school-based rules about bullying and harassment and discrimination. But in addition to that, you have states at the state level, state legislatures. So at least half of the states require schools to deal with disruptive harassment or bullying, even off campus. So those are existing rules already. And then you have federal laws, including Title IX about sex discrimination, which includes harassment, and Title VI, which includes race discrimination, and then laws about disability. So when you have that legal obligation that schools have on one hand, And then the First Amendment, on the other hand, that at this point, depending on what happens in this case, this cheerleading case, could tell schools, you can't regulate disruptive bullying if it is happening off campus, then the schools are in this kind of, you know, they're between a rock and a hard place. You know, what can they do in order to both comply with federal law and also to not run afoul of the First Amendment? And that goes to why this case is so important and why it is clearly necessary for the Supreme Court to lay out the contours of the rule so that public schools can know how to proceed.
You know, it just is a nightmare, and you can completely understand why Justice Breyer said that he's frightened to death of writing a standard. I mean, it's just fraught on every level. So arguments about free speech and censorship can be found in just about every sphere of American life. And last week on this program, I spoke to Jane Mayer and Alexandra Schwartz about Norton's cancellation of Blake Bailey's biography of Philip Roth and the decision of other publishers to cancel contracts with the authors of politically controversial books. First Amendment freedoms, as you've alluded to, are a big issue on college campuses. It's even harder to adjudicate the issues when it comes to teenagers who have such impulsive online behavior and the bullying that often goes along with that. So as you've thought through all of this, where, and maybe this is unfair, but where do you right now come down on this issue of students and free speech?
Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned the connection between the school arena and free speech and the other places in our society where we encounter this collision course of sorts between free speech principles and anti-harassment and bullying principles. It is really, the school arena seems very fraught because we're talking about kids who aren't fully formed. And we know that schools, one of their jobs is not only to fill their minds with information and knowledge, but also to form them as citizens who will be going forth in the world to hopefully have discourse about all kinds of ideas and to be able to, in a civil manner, disagree with each other. And you know, basically, people are democracy. The school case may seem extra fraught, but it's also the case that elsewhere in our society, people have even stronger free speech rights, and they have even stronger concerns about harassment, particularly race-based and sexually-based harassment. And so where I come down on the school case could be different from where I come down in the adult situations, because we do know that students have lesser free speech rights than adults, and that schools do have to have more power to regulate student speech because of the special educational function that they're engaged in. So in the school situation, to me, the idea that bullying and harassment has to really rise to the level of severe or pervasive before schools could regulate it, that scares me, even though I can understand where that principle comes from. I understand that it's a compromise between free speech and harassment. And so that does concern me. On the other hand, when it comes to adult situations where you've got a university campus or a regular workplace, there's been a movement, and somewhat successful, to get rid of the severe or pervasive requirement when it comes to harassment claims, so that someone could bring a claim for, say, unwelcome sexual conduct as sexual harassment without having to show that it was severe or pervasive. I think that reasonable minds could disagree about that, but in the adult context, I wouldn't feel as scared about having a severe or pervasive argument. It certainly does make it harder for accusers or alleged victims to be successful in their claims. But when you're balancing the value of free speech on the other side, it makes sense. The value of speech is very strong for adults, less strong for kids. And so that kind of balance makes more sense to me in the adult context.
Absolutely. Well said. And I hope you'll come back, Jeannie, to talk about, you know, how this works in other spheres. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Jeannie Suk Gerson is a contributing writer to The New Yorker and a professor at Harvard Law School. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.